That looks like the sign to begin. You hear me?
No.
Okay. We stopped in that very dry and factual chapter. We stopped at the families of Stephen and Bloom. And we realized that according to the name of Bloom's mother, Higgins and Hegarty, that does not seem to be a Jewish name. So that technically, Bloom mightn't even be Jewish, but that's a matter of how to determine it. Anyway, we go on now at the baptism.
Had Bloom and Stephen been baptized, and where and by whom? Cleric or layman? Bloom, three times, by the Reverend Mr. Gilmer Johnson, M.A., alone in the Protestant Church of St. Nicholas Without, Coombe, by James O'Connor, Philip Gilligan, and James Fitzpatrick, together under a pump in the village of Swords, and by the Reverend Charles Malone, C.C., in the Church of the Three Patrons, Rathcar. Stephen, once, by the Reverend Charles Malone, C.C., alone in the Church of the Three Patrons, Rathcar. Did they find their educational careers similar? Substituting Stephen for Bloom, Stoom would have passed successively through a dame school and the high school. Substituting Bloom for Stephen, Bleefen would have passed successively through the preparatory, junior, middle, and senior grades of the intermediate and through the matriculation, first arts, second arts, and arts degree courses of the Royal University. Why did Bloom refrain from stating that he had frequented the University of Life? Because of his fluctuating incertitude as to whether this observation had or had not been already made by him to Stephen, or by Stephen to him. What two temperaments do they individually represent? The scientific, the artistic. What proofs did Bloom adduce to prove that his tendency was towards applied rather than towards pure science? Certain possible inventions, of which he had cogitated when reclining in a state of supine repletion to aid digestion, stimulated by his appreciation of the importance of inventions, now common but once revolutionary, for example, the aeronautic parachute, the reflecting telescope, the spiral corkscrew, the safety pin, the mineral water siphon, the canal lock with winch and sluice, the suction pump. Were these inventions principally intended for an improved scheme of kindergarten? Yes. Rendering obsolete pop guns, elastic air bladders, games of hazard, catapults. They comprised astronomical kaleidoscopes exhibiting the 12 constellations of the zodiac from Aries to Pisces, miniature mechanical orreries, arithmetical gelatine lozenges, geometrical to correspond with zoological biscuits, globe map playing balls, historically costumed dolls.
Good. Bloom and Stephen being baptized, you notice that in Ireland they express baptized very often, and where and by when, cleric or layman. So this is a baptism. Bloom, three times, looks like a lot, by the Reverend Mr. Gilmer Johnson, M.A., alone, of the Protestant Church of St. Nicholas Without, Coombe. So he had, as we know, his father had converted to Protestantism, and of course he grew up as a Protestant and was then baptized. St. Nicholas without means without the city limits. Then the middle one, by James Connor, Philip Gilligan, and James Fitzpatrick, they're obviously not clergymen, together under the pump in the village of Swords. Now that looks like a kind of prank, possibly anti-Semitic. Duck him under water and do that. And that's what I thought. Until I have been told, and maybe some of you know that, that anyone can baptize anyone by sprinkling water over them and saying the right words. So we can baptize each other. I always thought that originally baptize means to dump in water, which is also true, but it seems to be everyone can, and there are some histories about that, so you can. And by the Reverend Charles Malone, C.C., the Church of Three Patrons, with God. And it turns out that Stephen was also baptized in the same church, although it is in the church of heaven, was God. Now, Brougham, of course, was baptized a Catholic when he married Molly, who was a Catholic. So Brougham, in a way, has been in all religions, Jewish, but he doesn't, he's not a practicing Jew, Protestant and Catholic. So he is in three churches and outside of them at the same time. And of course, if this baptism in a fountain had counted as a real baptism, Brougham would have been baptized twice. So you see, there are all kinds of complications. Did they find their education or career similar? They're obviously talking about their background. Substituting Stephen for Brougham, Stoom, here they are combined names, would have passed successfully through a dame school and the high school. So Brougham's education is the school of a dame and the high school. And something room for Stephen Bleven would have passed already through the preparatory, junior, middle, and senior grades of the intermediate and through the matriculation, first arts, second arts, and arts degree, of course, of the Royal University. So this is Stephen's academic thing. So he has been, he has a university degree. Brougham has only been to a middle school. Why did Brougham refrain from stating that he had frequented the University of Life? Not an academic one, but the University of Life. Because of his fluctuating incertitude as to whether this observation had not be made already, made by him to Stephen or by Stephen to him. He doesn't quite know if that has been said before. And if you have the same edition as mine, the Penguin, on page 585, in the brothel area, when he wasn't quite always awake, he did in fact say that, but he don't remember it. What two tempered did they individually represent? The scientific, the artistic. Yeah, Brougham is more scientific, though not a scientist, and Stephen, of course, is artistic. What proofs did Brougham adduce to prove that his tendency was towards applied rather than pure science, you know? The natural sciences can be applied academically or in practice. Obviously, the answer is applied. Certain possible inventions of which he had cogitated. Cogitate is just another word for thinking. And I believe it automatically takes us to Descartes, the philosopher, who says, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. When reclining in a state of supine repletion after a meal to aid digestion, stimulated by his appreciation of the importance of inventions now common, but once revolutionary. For example, three things of inventions that have improved our lives. The aeronautic parachute, the reflecting telescope, the spiral corkscrew. You see, the corkscrew had to be invented sometimes. The safety pin, they had lots of pins around it. The mineral water siphon, the canal lock with winch and sluice, and the suction pump. So these are inventions that improve the life. I asked, did we stop here? Were these inventions principally intended for an improved scheme of kindergarten. So Hume thinks of how children could be instructed to learn something. Yes, rendering obsolete pop guns, elastic air bladders, games of hazard, catapults. So Broom doesn't want to have toy guns and things like that. They comprised astronomical kaleidoscopes, exhibited the 12th constellation of the zodiac from the Earth to Pisces. You could have a device so that they would learn the zodiac. Miniature mechanical orreries, when you could see the various planets. Arithmetical gelatin lozenges with numbers on them, so while you have them, you could learn mathematics. Geometrical to correspond with zoological biscuits. Biscuits in the shape of animals. Globe maps, play balls, historically costumed dolls. All of these things, don't think, could be learned, could be used to aid education. Now we come.
What also stimulated him in his cogitations? The financial success achieved by Ephraim Marx and Charles A. James, the former by his penny bazaar at 42 Georgia Street South, the latter at his sixpenny halfpenny shop, and World's Fancy Fair and Waxwork Exhibition at 30 Henry Street, admission tuppence, children a penny, and the infinite possibilities hitherto unexploited of the modern art of advertisement, if condensed in triliteral monoidal symbols, vertically of maximum visibility divined, horizontally of maximum legibility deciphered, and of magnetizing efficacy to arrest involuntary attention, to interest, to convince, to decide. Such as K2, Kino's 11 shilling trousers, House of Keys, Alexander J. Keys. Such as not. Look at this long candle. Calculate when it burns out, and you receive gratis one pair of our special non-compo boots, guaranteed one candle power. Address Barclay and Cook, 18 Talbot Street. Basilical, insect powder. Very best, boot blacking. You want it. Combine pocket two-blade penknife with corkscrew, nail file, and pipe cleaner. Such as never. What is home without Plumtree's potted meat? Incomplete. With it, an abode of bliss. Manufactured by George Plumtree, 23 Merchants Quay, Dublin, put up in 4-ounce pots, and inserted by Councillor Joseph P. Nannetti, MP, Rotunda Ward, 19 Harcourt Street, under the obituary notices and anniversaries of deceases. The name on the label is Plumtree, a Plumtree in a meat pot, registered trademark, beware of imitations, Pietmont, Trumplee, Montpat, Plumtree. Which example did he adduce to induce Stephen to deduce that originality, though producing its own reward, does not invariably conduce to success? His own ideated and rejected project of an illuminated chokecart drawn by a beast of burden in which two smartly dressed girls were to be seated engaged in writing.
What stimulated him in his thinking, cogitation? The financial success achieved by Ephraim Marx and Charles James, the former by his one penny bazaar at 42 Georgia Street South, the latter at his 6½ halfpenny shop and World's Fancy Fair and Waxwork at 30 Henry Street. Admission to shillings, children, no, pennies, children one penny. So these were people who were successful in business. One has a bazaar where everything is cheap, and another is the waxworks at Henry Street. So this is the Dublin equivalent of Madame Tussaud in London. And there is a wax. I've been there many years ago. Didn't like their choice. And the infinite possibilities hitherto unexploited of the modern art of advertisement, if condensed, and the ideal advertisement, in triliteral monoideal symbols, there will be three letters, it means. Now it so happens that Hebrew words are triliteral. They have three consonants. vertical of maximum visibility, divined, horizontally by maximum legibility. It should be legible and short, deciphered, and of magnetizing efficacy to arrest or involve attention, to interest, to convince, to decide. And of course, this is the ideal advertisement that I should have. Such as, now we have examples, the Bloom saw, K, 11, key nose, 11, shilling, trousers. We saw that in the 8th chapter. House of Keys, Alexander J. Keys. That is, of course, the advertisement that Bloom is after. Such as not, then the bad examples. Look at his long candle. Calculate when he burns out and you receive greatness. One pair of our special non-compost boots, guaranteed one candle power. Address Barclay and Cook, 18 Talbot Street. So it was obviously a candle in a window, and you have to guess how long it burns. And you get it. Now, this ad actually was in the paper. I found it there, and it was a real one. Or, and these are bad, you can see these are plays on words that are very simple. Basilikill, insect powder. Very best, boot blacking. You want it. Combined pocket two-blade penknife with corkscrew nail file and pipe cleaner. That's a kind of Swiss Army knife. No. Such as never. What is home without plum trees, potted meat, that Bloom read in the 5th chapter and is one of the motives. Incomplete, with it an abode of bliss. Manufactured by George Plumtree, 23 Merchant Street, Dublin, put up in 4-ounce pots and inserted by Count Joseph Binetti, MP, Rotunda Ward, 19 Hardwick Street, under the obituary notices and anniversary of deceased. So Bloom saw the advertisement on the first page under the obituary notices. That wasn't true of the newspaper at the time. And then, and this looks very modern, the name on the label is Plumtree. A Plumtree is a meat pot. Registered trademark, beware of imitations. Peatmot, Trumply, Montpat, Plumtree. So, you know, you can copyright brand names, and here is that the other names would probably be problematic in court. So again, it's several different things, several different names for the same thing. Then, which example did he induce Stephen to deduce that originality, though producing its own reward, does not invariably conduce to success? So again, this is put all in English words with a Latin origin. And if you look at it again, you probably notice the first time, you will realize that these are all Latin-derived words, composite of dut, ducere, or to lead, adduce, induce, deduce, produce, conduce. So there's another little formal trick behind it. His own ideated and rejected project of illuminated show cart drawn by a beast of burden, donkey, in which two smartly dressed girls were to be seated engaging in writing. This idea we already heard in chapter 8 when Bloom complained that his employer, Healis, did not accept his idea of a show car to the cities. That would have been, of course, a relatively expensive way of advertising, not worth the trouble. And then what suggested scene was then constructed by Stephen. And now Stephen, in turn, has something. And it's a bit problematic. Stephen, in a way, sketches a theatre, a play where nothing is spoken. These are like stage directions. Solid Hotel in Mountain Pass, autumn, twilight, firelit. In the dark corner, young man seated. Young woman enters, restless, solitary. She sits, she goes to the window. She stands, she sits, twilight. She thinks, on solid hotel paper, she writes. She thinks, she writes, she sighs. Wheels and hoofs, she hurries out. He comes from his dark corner. He sees his solitary paper. He holds it towards fire, twilight. He reads, solitary. You see what the problem is? You can say that, and that is like a play. It's like some Beckett plays, actually, where you have nothing but gestures. But how does Stephen, does he read it out aloud? He must, otherwise Stephen would hear it. But there doesn't seem to be something that lends itself to be read aloud. What is he writing? And then it says, in sloping upright and backhand, letters leading back, Queen's Hotel, Queen's Hotel, Queen's Ho. So that is what I mean. What suggested scene was then reconstructed by Bloom. It so happens, as we may remember, that Bloom's father owned the Queen's Hotel in Ennis. And there he committed suicide. So by coincidence, the Queen's Hotel is in Stephen's invention and also Bloom. The Queen's Hotel, Ennis, County Clare, where Rudolf Virag died on the evening of the 1786. At some hour unstated, in consequence of an overdose of monkshood aconite, a poison, self-administered in the form of a neuralgic liniment, a kind of ointment that's neuralgic, composed of two parts of aconite, liniment of one, to one of chloroform liniment, so that's a painkiller, purchased by him at 10:20 a.m. in the morning of 17 June 1886 at the medical hall of Francis Denet, 12 Church of Ennis, after having, though not in consequence of having, purchased at 3:15 p.m. on the afternoon of 27 June 1886, a new Boater straw hat, extra smart, after having, though not in consequence of having, purchased at the hour and in the place aforesaid. So you see, it so happens that the Queen's Hotel is also the name of the hotel that Bloom's father owned and where he committed suicide. And the information we get is what would have come out at the inquest, you know, when somebody dies of an unnatural death, accident, or then there is an inquest where the court finds out what is the cause, and the cause has obviously been suicide, but of course, usually the coroner, the judge, says it was by mistake, by accident, it wasn't an intention, because suicide would have been a crime. So that is. But the strange thing is, and that's why this chapter has more questions than answers. Okay, but if you're going to take your life, life. Why are you going to buy a straw hat? There's something. at the General Clipper Store, James Collin, 4 Main Street, Ennis. The addresses are always given pedantically. So it does stop.
What?
I think I wrote for Shelton.
Yeah, we can do that.
We attribute this homonymity to information or coincidence or intuition. Coincidence. Did he depict the scene verbally for his guest to see? He preferred himself to see another's face and listen to another's words, by which potential narration was realized and kinetic temperament relieved. Did he see only a second coincidence in the second scene narrated to him, described by the narrator as a Pishog site of Palestine or the parable of the plums? It, with the preceding scene, and with others unnarrated but existent by implication, to which add essays on various subjects or moral apothegms, e.g. My Favorite Hero or Procrastination is the Thief of Time, composed during school years, seemed to him to contain in itself and in conjunction with the personal equation certain possibilities of financial, social, personal, and sexual success, with especially collected and selected as modeled pedagogic themes of 100% merit for the use of preparatory and junior grade students, or contributed in printed form, following the precedent of Philip Beaufoy or Dr. Dick or Heblon's Studies in Blue, to a publication of certified circulation and solvency, or employed verbally as intellectual stimulation for sympathetic auditors, tacitly appreciative of successful narrative, and confidently augurative of successful achievement, during the increasingly longer nights gradually following the summer solstice on the day but three following. Vita Lisset, Tuesday the 21st of June, St. Aloysius Gonzaga, sunrise 3:33 a.m., sunset 8:29 p.m.
Did you attribute this homonymity, the same name, as you can tell, to information or coincidence or intuition? Why comes it strange that Stephen should come up with a story with the same name of the hotel? When Bloom thinks it's coincidence, accidentally. Did he depict the scene verbally for his guest to see? So did he? And the answer doesn't quite obtain. He preferred himself to see another's face and listen to another's words, by which potential narration was realized and kinetic temperament relieved. It seems to say, no, he didn't want to say something. He'd rather listen. Did he see only a second coincidence in the second scene narrated to him? Described by the narrator as a Pisgah site of Palestine or the parable of the plums. So, Stephen tells something else, and remember, he had in the seventh chapter, as they left the newspaper office crossing the street, told a story he had made up of two women from the suburbs. He went to the city center, climbed up Nelson's pillar and spit down the stones. And when he was asked for a title, he said, the Pisgah site of Palestine. And that is, we may have forgotten it, that is that Moses from Mount Pisgah saw the Holy Land, but didn't get there. And the second title that Stephen gave, that's page 189 in many editions, is the parable of the plums that they have. And you know, in the New Testament, Jesus speaks in parables of plums and of things like that. So that takes you back to the end of chapter 7. But it is not quite answered. With a preceding scene and with other unnarrated things that were not told, but existed by implication, to which add essays on various subjects or moral apothegms, the kind of school essays that you had to do, usually with a moralistic turn. My Favorite Hero, that's a kind of typical for a schoolboy essay, Aufsatz. Or procrastination is the thief of time. You have to write essays on these moral talks. Composed during school years seemed to him to contain in itself and in conjunction with a personal equation certain possibilities of financial, social, personal and sexual success. So all these stories may have some advice. Whether specifically collected and selected as model pedagogic themes of 100% merit for the use of preparatory and junior grade students and contributed in printed form following the precedent of Philip Beaufoy or Dr. Dick of Hebron Studies in Blue. So that was obviously a book. I think it's a Jewish author, to a publication of certified circulation and solvency, or implied verbally as intellectual stimulation for sympathetic auditors, tacitly appreciation of successful narratives, and confidently inaugurative of successful achievement during the increasingly longer nights gradually following the summer solstice. This being the 17th of June, close to the summer, and the days would get shorter. They already are getting shorter. On the day following, through the 21st of June, that's the longest day, and then days get shorter. Saint Aloysius Gonzaga, this is the patron saint of the 21st of June. Sunrise, 3:33 a.m., sunset, 8:29 p.m. So here you learn what in 1904, when the sun set in Dublin on the longest day, if you want to know. That's it.
Which domestic problem, as much as, if not more than any other, frequently engaged his mind? What to do with our wives? What had been his hypothetical singular solutions? Parlor games, dominoes, halma, tiddlywinks, spillikins, cup and ball, nap, spoil five, bezique, 25, beggar my neighbor, draughts, chess, or backgammon. Embroidery, darning or knitting for the police-aided clothing society. Musical duets, mandolin and guitar, piano and flute, guitar and piano. Legal scrivenery or envelope addressing. Bi-weekly visits to variety entertainments, commercial activity as pleasantly commanding and pleasingly obeyed mistress proprietress in a cool dairy shop, or warm cigar divan, the clandestine satisfaction of erotic irritation in masculine brothels, state inspected and medically controlled, social visits at regular infrequent preventive intervals and with regular frequent preventative superintendents to and from female acquaintances of recognized respectability in the vicinity, courses of evening instruction, specially designed to render liberal instruction agreeable. What instances of deficient mental development in his wife inclined him in favor of the last mentioned ninth solution? In disoccupied moments, she had more than once covered a sheet of paper with signs and hieroglyphics, which she stated were Greek and Irish and Hebrew characters. She had interrogated constantly, at varying intervals, as to the correct method of writing the capital initial of the name of a city in Canada, Quebec. She understood little of political complications, internal or balance of power external. In calculating the addenda of bills, she frequently had recourse to digital aid. After completion of laconic epistolary compositions, she abandoned the implement of calligraphy in the encaustic pigment exposed to the corrosive action of copperas, green vitriol, and nutgall. Unusual polysyllables of foreign origin she interpreted phonetically, or by false analogy, or by both. Metempsychosis, metempsychosis, alias, a mendacious person mentioned in sacred scripture. What compensated in the false balance of her intelligence for these and such deficiencies of judgment regarding persons, places, and things? The false apparent parallelism of all perpendicular arms of all balances proved true by construction. The counterbalance of her proficiency of judgment regarding one person proved true by experiment. How had he attempted to remedy this state of comparative ignorance? Variously, by leaving in a conspicuous place a certain book open at a certain page, by assuming in her, when alluding explanatorily, latent knowledge, thy open ridicule in her presence of some absent other's ignorant lapse. With what success had he attempted direct instruction? She followed not all, a part of the whole, gave attention with interest, comprehended with surprise, with care repeated, with greater difficulty remembered, forgot with ease, with misgiving re-remembered, re-repeated with error. What system had proved more effective? Indirect suggestion implicating self-interest. Example. She disliked umbrella with rain. He liked woman with umbrella. She disliked new hat with rain. He liked woman with new hat. He bought new hat with rain. She carried umbrella with new hat.
Good. I know. Which domestic problem? I know. As much as, if not more than, any other frequently engaged his mind. What to do with our wives? What to, and this answered a little bit the question of what the Blooms would have done on an ordinary week evening. How did they pass the time? What had been his hypothetical singular solution? Parlor games, dominoes, Alma, Tiddlywinks, I think that's when you snap these, what we call floor, huh? I believe. Spillikins, I don't know what that is. Cup and ball, nap, spoil five bezique, 25, beggar my neighbor draft, chess or backgammon. So these were the games that you could play to pass the time. Then the other thing is embroidery. Darning or knitting for the police-aided clothing society. You could do some darning or knitting and gave it to a good purpose, like the police clothing society, to knit things for the poor. Musical duets, mandolin and guitar, piano and flute, guitar and piano. Legal scrivenery or envelope addressing. There had been a lot to do with simply, let's say, to write envelopes, to write addresses on envelopes, that kind of thing. I think before my time, there was something like a Schreibstube where you could do that sort of work. Biweekly visits to variety entertainments, that would be expensive. Commercial activity as pleasantly commanding and pleasingly obeyed mistress, proprietors in a cool dairy shop or warm cigar. You could run or work in a shop, a dairy, when you could have a late coffee, or a warm cigar divan. That would be a shop where people can smoke and buy cigar. The clandestine satisfaction of erotic irritation in masculine brothels. I suppose that's probably where men are the prostitutes. State inspected and medically controlled. Social visits at regular, infrequent, preventive intervals and with regular, frequent, preventive superintendents. To and from female acquaintances of recognized respectability in the vicinity. Courses of evening instruction specially designed to render liberal instructing agreeable. So these would be pastimes or even ways of making a little bit of money that you could occupy yourself with. What instances of deficient mental development? That's strongly put. Obviously, Molly isn't quite as educated as he, and certainly not as much as Stephen Dedalus, in his wife, inclined him in favour of the last mentioned, ninth solution, that is evening instruction and things like that. And by the way, you didn't realise that the previous chapter had nine headings, and it did, in fact, as we now see. in disoccupied moments, he had more than once covered a sheet of paper she had with signs and hieroglyphics, which he stated were Greek and Irish and Hebrew characters. Now, she obviously scribbled something and said, perhaps as a joke, of course he doesn't know Greek and Irish or Hebrew. She had interrogated constantly at varying intervals as to the correct method of writing the capital initial of the name of city in Canada, Quebec. And Quebec is perhaps not so easy to spell. She understood little of political complications, internal or balance of power. Balance of power was always said that the British policy was to keep a balance of power in Europe, that no country would become too strong. External. In calculating the addenda of bills, she frequently had recourse to digital aid, the hands, the fingers, or digits. After completion of laconic epistolary compositions, when she had written a letter, epistolary, laconic. Now, the word laconic is here wrongly used. Laconic means you are short and to the point. What everybody in this world is not. If you ever have been at a meeting and things like that, you know that. Laconic means short and to the point. But laconic, the letters were obviously with very few words. But that is not laconic, that is simply a short letter with not much content. I want to say that sometimes the precision that is apparent is a bit fake. It's not quite true. Epistolary composition, and you see in English you can say epistolary composition, or you can say letter writing, the two vocabularies. She abandoned the implement of calligraphy. Calligraphy is, of course, writing beautiful, like an artist. And that's not, letters were probably not written very calligraphically. In encaustic pigment exposed to gross accent of copper screen, vitriol, and nut gall. That's the content of ink. It had a green vitriol. Copper and nut gall, and of course you should not leave your metallic pen in the ink. They sometimes were spoiled. Unusual syllables of foreign origin she interpreted phonetically or by false analogy or by both. And the examples are metempsychosis. Remember in the first bedroom chapter, chapter 4, she said, what's the word metempsychosis? And she spelled it, she said, met him pike hoses. And then he explained it. Or alias. Alias means actually elsewhere, but you can give an alias instead of your own name. You give an alias, a mendacious person mentioned in sacred scripture. She's confusing alias with the name of a mendacious person in the Bible. There's a liar and he's called Ananias, and not alias. So she can confuse these words. What compensated in the false balance of her intelligence for these and such deficiencies of judgment regarding persons, places, and things? So she may not be too educated, but she has other qualities. By the way, persons, places, and things, that's a grammatical definition of a noun. A noun is a word for a person, a place, or a thing. The false apparent parallelism of all perpendicular arms of all balances. through two prayer instructions. Now that means the arm, the perpendicular arms or balances scales are parallel through prayer. I don't quite get what he means, something physical. The counterbalance of her profession of judgment regarding one person proved to by experiment. But she can only have a good judgment of persons. How had he attempted to remedy the state of comparative ignorance? Variously, by leaving in a conspicuous place a certain book open at a certain page, yeah, so that you might then read this page and learn something. By assuming in her, when alluding explanatorily, latent knowledge, implying that she knows what it is already, to encourage her. By open ridicule in her presence of some absent others, ignorant. He doesn't make fun of her when she doesn't know, but he mentions somebody who doesn't know. And here can make a point. With what success had he attempted direct instruction? She followed not all, a part of whom gave attention with interest, comprehended with surprise, with care repeated, with greater difficulty re-remembered, forgot with ease, with misgiving, re-remembered, re-repeated with error. So I was trying to do something for her memory. What system had proved more effective? Indirect suggestion implicating self-interest. Of course, if you're interested in your self-interest, you learn better, naturally. Example. She disliked umbrella with rain. He liked woman with umbrella. She disliked new hat with rain. He liked woman with new hat. He bought her new hat with rain. She carried umbrella with new hat. So, no, that's very old.
Accepting the analogy implied in his guest's parable, which examples of post-exilic eminence did he adduce? Three seekers of the pure truth, Moses of Egypt, Moses Maimonides, author of More in Epicum, Guide of the Perplexed, and Moses Mendelssohn, of such eminence that from Moses of Egypt to Moses Mendelssohn, there arose none like Moses Maimonides. What statement was made, under correction by Bloom, concerning a fourth seeker of pure truth, by name Aristotle, mentioned with permission by Stephen? That the seeker mentioned had been a pupil of a rabbinical philosopher, name uncertain. Were other anapocryphal illustrious sons of the law and children of a selected or rejected race mentioned? Felix Bartholdy Mendelssohn, composer. Baruch Spinoza, philosopher. Mendoza, pugilist. Ferdinand LaSalle, reformer, dualist. What fragments of verse from the ancient Hebrew and ancient Irish languages were cited with modulations of voice and translation of texts by guest to host and by host to guest? By Stephen, Shul, 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 arun, shul, gusakar, agashul, gukun. Walk, walk, walk your way, walk in safety, walk with care. By Bloom, Kifeloch, Haremon, Rakatesh, Imbad, Zamatesh. Thy temple amid thy hair is as a slice of pomegranate. How was a glyphic comparison of the phonic symbols of both languages made in substantiation of the oral comparison? On the penultimate blank page of a book of inferior literary style, entitled Sweets of Sin, produced by Bloom and so manipulated that its front cover came in contact with the surface of the table, with a pencil supplied by Stephen, Stephen wrote the Irish characters for G, A, D, M, simple and modified. And Bloom, in turn, wrote the Hebrew characters Gimel, Aleph, Dalet, and in the absence of Mem, substituted Gop, explaining their arithmetical values as ordinal and cardinal numbers, Videlicet 3, 1, 4, and 100. Was the knowledge possessed by both of each of these languages, the extinct and the revived, theoretical or practical? Theoretical, being confined to certain grammatical rules of accidence and syntax, and practically excluding vocabulary.
So now they exchange a few things about names. Accepting the analogy implied in his guest's parable, the parable of the plums, which example of post-exilic eminence did he use? Post-exilic, you know that the Jews were in exile in Egypt. Post-exilic eminence did he use? Three secrets of pure truth. Moses is the one who led the Jews out of the exile to the Holy Land. Moses Maimonides, who is a philosopher, Arab and Jewish in the Middle Ages, author of More Neupkim, and he wrote, in fact, A Guide of the Perplexed. You can see the suitability in this book of A Guide of the Perplexed, because we sometimes are quite perplexed and need a guide. Then Moses Mendelssohn, you know that Bloom has already met Moses Mendelssohn, a successful Jewish composer of such eminence. So there are several Moses. We know only the first and the last, probably, from Egypt to Moses Mendelssohn. What statement was made under correction by Bloom concerning a fourth seeker for truth by name Aristotle, mentioned with permission by Stephen? There had been a rumor that Aristotle, the Greek philosopher, had also been learned from a Jewish philosopher. That the seeker mentioned had been a pupil of a rabbinical philosopher named Anselm. So there was a story that Aristotle had been, and that of course would combine the two roots of our civilization, on the one hand the Hebrew one, and then the Greek one. What other apocryphal is when it's mentioned in documents that haven't become part of the canon, that are hidden away, that exist but aren't quite accepted. But that is an apocrypha is real. Illustrious son of the law and children of his elected race mentioned. So they have Felix Bartholdi Mendelssohn, the composer, Baruch Spinoza, philosopher, Bloom in Cyclops mentioned famous philosophers, and he mentioned Spinoza and Mendelssohn. He also mentioned Marx. Mendoza was in fact a boxer. And you know, since Jews were generally supposed, erroneously, to be weak, so there was a sportsman and boxer Mendoza. And Ferdinand Lassalle, he was one of the German social democrats, the origin Lassalle. So the social democrat in Germany go back, among others, to Lassalle. He was a reformer, and he also, it seemed, died in a duel. What fragments of verse from the ancient Hebrew and ancient Irish language? So these are the roots of both of them. Bloom in Hebrew, Stephen in Irish, but they don't know much about them. Were cited with modulations of voice, the pronunciation is difficult, and translation of text by guest to host and by host to guest. Stephen, Augustine. And this is translated, walk, walk, walk your way, walk in safety and with care. This is an Irish, old Irish song. Bloom. And you see, this is now Hebrew. Bloom knows a little bit of Hebrew. Kifaloch, harimam rakachek, mi baad, tavis. Thy temple amid thy hair is a slice of pomegranate. And this is from the Song of Songs, Solomon's Song. That is the part in the Bible that is actually quite erotic. It is a husband and a bride. And the Christians have always had difficulty, and they said this is Jesus Christ and the church or something like that. But it is quite well, it had great attractions to Oscar Wilde. And there's even in Faust, there is a reference to it. How was the glyphic, that is, written, sketched, comparison of the phonic symbol of both languages made in substantiation of the oral comparison? They don't know what, but they write down a few. On the penultimate blank page of a book of inferior literary style entitled Sweets of Sin. There's no paper around, don't forget. Paper was quite rare. You didn't have it at your fingertips. But Bloom is carrying the book, Sweets of Sin, and it has a few empty blank pages. Sweets of Sin, produced by Bloom. And so manipulated that its front cover came in contact with the surface of the table. That means he is doing it, that the title cannot be read. By the way, here the word is manipulated. And you can see the origin of manipulated, to do something with your hands, to manipulate the book, turn it around with your hands. With a pencil, supplied by Stephen. Stephen, as a presenter, has a pencil around. Stephen wrote the Irish characters for G, A, D, M, simple and modified. So he writes a few. Now in Irish, characters can be modified. And if you've ever seen Irish, it has all kinds of little squiggles on top and all of that. And Bloom in turn wrote the Hebrew characters, Gimel, Aleph, Daleth, and the absence of Mem, substitute Gof. That is, Gimel is C, Aleph is Alpha, Daleth is D, Mem is M, and Gof is another one. So he knows a few. Stephen knows a little bit of Irish, Bloom knows a little bit, but they're not really familiar with their background. As ordinal and cardinal numbers, these letters also have arithmetic sounds. Ordinal and cardinal numbers 3, 1, 4, and 100. What's the knowledge possessed by both of each of those languages, the extinct and the revived? Hebrew was extinct, though it, of course, it never went away. It was always read and revived because Irish had been revived in Joyce's time. Theoretical or practical? Theoretical, being confined to certain grammatical rules of accidence and syntax and practically excluding vocabulary. So they know a little bit, but they don't really know many, many words. Yeah. And now the next one. We don't get them.
Genealogical, hagiographical, exegetical, instituted about Phineas Farsakh, descendant of Noah, progenitor of Israel antiquity, both having been taught on the plain of Shinar 242 years after the deluge in the seminary instituted by Phineas Pharsakh, descendant of Noah, progenitor of Israel, and descendant of Heber and Heremon, progenitors of Ireland. Their archaeological, genealogical, hagiographical, exegetical, homiletic, toponomastic, historical, and religious literatures, comprising the works of rabbis and chaldees, Torah, Talmud, Mishnah, and Gemara, Masor, Pentateuch, Book of the Dun Cow, Book of Ballymote, Garland of Hoth, Book of Kells. Their dispersal, persecution, survival, and revival, the isolation of the synagogical and ecclesiastical rites in Ghetto, St. Mary's Abbey, and Mass House, Adam and Eve's Tavern, the prescription of their national costumes and penal laws and Jewish dress acts, the restoration in Canaan David of Zion, and the possibility of Irish political autonomy or devolution. What anthem did Bloom chant partially in anticipation of that multiple, ethnically irreductible consummation? Nefesh Yehudi Homia. Why was the chant arrested at the conclusion of this first distich? In consequence of defective memotechnic. How did the chanter compensate for this deficiency? By a paraphrastic version of the general text.
Okay.
What point of contact existed between these languages? They compare them now between the peoples who spoke them. The presence of guttural sounds. Hebrew has got, Swiss German is guttural, and in Irish too you have diacritic aspirations. In Hebrew there are no vowels. They only do the con, and they have little squiggles on top for the, so these are diacritic aspiration is when there's an H in front of it. Epenthetic and servile letters in both languages. There are certain letters that are not pronounced and put in. Servile and epenthetic means put in, things like that. So these are technical terms. In both languages, their antiquity, both having been taught on the plain of Shinar, 242 years after the deluge, to a seminary instituted by Phineas Pharsakh, descendant of Noah. So in certain Irish documents, old, they claim that they were descended from the Jews, which, of course, there's no evidence. And there was a Pharsakh, and he was a descendant. You see, this is an Irish name, descendant of Noah, progenitor of Israel. Noah is the one who survived. And ascendant of Heber and Heremon. Heber and Heremon are supposed to be at the beginning of the Irish race. They are legendary, not historical. Progenitors of Ireland. They're archaeological, and of course archaeology had just begun, that you dig in the earth and find ruins and things. Genealogical. Hagiographical, that is the lives of saints. Exegetical, this is interpretation. Homiletic, that is religious. Toponomatic, when the names of places, that's also, you know that certain villages were of Celtic origin and so on. Historical and religious literature, comprising the work of rabbis and Chaldees. Chaldees are the learned people in the Irish tradition. Torah, Talmud, Mishnah, and Gerard, these are part of the Jewish tradition. They are studied intensely. Masor, Pentateuch are the first books of Moses. And then in Ireland, you have a Book of the Dun Cow, Book of Ballymote, Garland of Hoth, Book of Kells. Now, of course, these are not on a level because the Jewish books, they were in a way holy texts, they were descended from heaven. But in the Irish antiquities are basically part of the Bible in beautiful writing. On the whole Book of Kells, their dispersal, persecution, both the Jews and the Irish have been dispersed. Most Irish live in the States. Persecution, survival and revival, the isolation of their synagogue mechanism rights in ghettos, St. Mary's Abbey and Marsh House, Adam and Eve's Tavern, and for a certain time they could not have their religious meetings and had to go to synagogues that were hidden away. They weren't allowed to practice their religions and rites in ghettos. And St. Mary's Abbey, and we heard of St. Mary's Abbey in chapter 10, page 295, if you want, which was once a Jewish synagogue, and Marsh House, Adam and Eve's Tavern. For a time, the Catholics were also not allowed to attend Mass. They had to be hidden. And one of them was Adam and Eve's Tavern. There was a pub, a public house called Adam and Eve's. And you see, that is not the name of a church originally. And so there was also a tavern. And so pious Catholics said, we're going to the tavern. And they went to the church that was hidden. And in fact, if you pass past Adam and Eve's, you will hardly see it. Now, of course, it's often the other way. You say you go to church, and yet you go drinking. So there's a certain similarity. In penal laws and Jewish press acts, there were laws, penal laws, forbid the Catholics from certain professions, and Jews were at times compelled to wear usually yellow dresses to keep them distinct. The restoration of Jonathan David of Zion, and that has to do with, remember, Elijah is coming back at the Church of Zion, and the possibility of political autonomy and devolution. And the Irish hoped at that time to get their own autonomy, that is, home rule. So, you see, this chapter repeats a lot that we heard earlier on. What anthem did Bloom chant? He obviously knows enough. Partially in anticipation of that multiple ethnically irreducible consummation, that the Jews have their own state, was of course a hope of the future. In the meantime, it came to pass. The multiple ethnic reducible consummation, rather. And Bloom, I don't think he sings it as well as he actually did. Bloom sings it. And it's now, I believe, the national anthem of the Jews of Jerusalem. And why was the chant the resting conclusion of his distich in consequence of defective mnemotechnic? Now, it isn't given. Let me see. The translation is there. It says more or less, as long as deep within the heart, the soul of Judea is turbulent and strong. So, and this, the opening, the hope, which became the anti-Zionist movement, and it's the anthem of Israel. In other words, they know a little bit of their own language. But why was it in consequence of defective mnemotechnic, that is, forgotten, they have forgotten it, defective mnemotechnic. How did the chanter reckon for the deficiency by a periphractic version of a general text? He gives, in a way, a description of it, of the general text. Good.
In what common study do their mutual reflections merge? The increasing simplification, traceable from the Egyptian epigraphic hieroglyphs to the Greek and Roman alphabets, and the anticipation of modern stenography and telegraphic code in the cuneiform inscriptions, Semitic, and the Virgilioquinque Costate Oum writing, Celtic. Did the guest comply with his host's request? Doubly, by appending his signature in Irish and Roman characters. What was Stephen's auditive sensation? He heard, in a profound, ancient, male, unfamiliar melody, the accumulation of the past. What was Bloom's visual sensation? He saw, in a quick young male familiar form, the predestination of a future. What were Stephen's and Bloom's quasi-simultaneous volitional quasi-sensations of concealed identities? Visually, Stephen's, the traditional figure of hypostasis, depicted by Ioannes Damascenus, Lentulus Romanus, and Epiphanius Monachus as leucodermic, sesquipedalian, with wine-dark hair. Auditively, Bloom's, the traditional accent of the ecstasy of catastrophe. Stop. What future career?
No, we stop here, Marola. It's a tough passage. In what common study did their mutual reflections merge? The increasing simplification traceable from the Egyptian epigraphic hieroglyphics, and you see here that writing originally was very complicated and only a few select people could actually do it. The majority have no clue. And of course, Egyptian hieroglyphs with all these figures and birds and things like that is a very complicated. And I'm glad we didn't have to go to an Egyptian school, that kind of thing. To the Greek and Roman alphabets, the Greek and Roman, the alphabet we have, depend on the Semitic one that the Jews had, Semitic. And of course, and you see, the alphabets become simpler and simpler. Now we have basically 25 letters. That's much easier than the system of Egypt. And in some way, I would say, this book you're reading is also a glorification of the alphabet. The alphabets, there are many, of course, are some of the most important inventions of mankind. What would we do without the alphabets? We wouldn't have any idea of what happened a few thousand years ago. So this is something. And the addition of modern stenography, and of course stenography don't do this, I still had to learn it, is to make it as simple and as quick as possible. Imagine how long it would take for an Egyptian stonemason to have a whole steel, you know, that took months and things like that. And stenography you can write very quickly. And telegraphic code, telegraph and Morse symbols. In the cuneiform inscriptions, Semitic. Originally, there was cuneiform, cuneus, this is Kyle script, you know, the Babylonians and the Assyrians had that. They simply had, or not simply had, a thing that they etched into clay. And then so you couldn't do very much. You have just more or less pressure. Semitic. And the Virgilioquinque Costate Oum writing, Celtic, the Irish had a form of writing that was called Oum, Ogam, and this is has usually certain lines, or 1 to 5 lines. It's all lines. It's very simple. And it's five ribs. So we often have 5 lines. We could show it in the foundation, but you don't have it. And you can look it up, Oum, I would look as you do it. did the guest comply with his host's request? Doubly, the guest also Bloom already asked him, would you write your name in the book? Doubly, by appending his signature in Irish and Roman characters. And you know, Irish is a bit different. And you know, when you go to Ireland, everything has to be first in Irish and then in the Roman character. Now we come to a difficult passage. What was Stephen's auditive sensation here? He heard in a profound ancient male unfamiliar melody the accumulation of the past. Well, Jewish tradition goes very far back. So that is true. What was Bloom's visual sensation? He saw in a quick young male familiar form the predestination of a future. There's something ahead of Stephen. Stephen has a long career before himself. But now, what was Stephen and Bloom's quasi is not quite, as we know, simultaneous, volitional, quasi sensations of concealed identities? What did they see in each other? Visually, Stephen's, the traditional figure of hypostasis or hypostasis, depicted by Johannes the Muscular, Lentulus, Romanus, and Epimachus as leucodermic, sesquipedalian, and wine dark hair. That is, how do we know what Jesus looked? And there are very few descriptions of Jesus. The Bible doesn't say anything. We now have an additional figure, but you don't find that in the tradition. And so there were an hypostasis. Hypostasis means many, many things. It's a complicated word. Here it means the unity of God the Father and Jesus. So that, and these three names, Thomasinus, Lentulus, they have descriptions of Jesus that are overlapping, but not the, and the church itself says that they are not genuine, they're forgeries. So this is a little evidence. And they describe Jesus leucodermic, that is like a medical term when you are white skinned. But I said Jesus had white skin and wine dark hair, dark reddish hair. Wine dark is also the name of Odyssey, the wine dark sea. But sesquipedalian is something very special. Sesquipedalian means one and a half syllables. Now, it's a bit complicated. Now, there was a belief, and we can read it in Joyce's first novel, Stephen. There was a belief that Jesus was exactly 6 feet tall. Now, I don't know whether they measured people in feet in, you know, in Hebrew, exactly 6 feet. And sesquipedalian means not 6 feet, but 1.5 feet. And so it was that. And he had wine dark hair. So this is what they say. Now, we have one book in the library by a Catholic scholar who says, this is the most thing in the whole book. Everything is that Stephen and Jesus are one. I don't believe it myself, but somebody makes a big thing of it. Though Joyce added this very late, this wasn't the beginning. Then auditively, here, the traditional accent of the ecstasy of catastrophe. I don't quite know what is the accent of the Exodus catastrophe. I honestly don't get it. Yeah, then you can still read a little bit, yeah.
What future careers have been possible for Bloom in the past, and with what exemplars? In the Church, Roman, Anglican, or Nonconformist, exemplars, the very Reverend John Conley, S.J., and Reverend T. Salmon, D.D., Provost of Trinity College, Dr. Alexander J. Dowie. At the bar, English or Irish, exemplars, Seymour Bush, K.C., Rufus Isaacs, K.C. On the stage, modern or Shakespearean exemplars, Charles Wyndham, High Comedian, Osmond Teale, 1901, exponent of Shakespeare.
Good. I think we stopped there then. So it says, what future careers had been possible for Bloom in the past, and what are the models? In the Church, Roman, Anglican, and Nonconformist. Exemplars, the very Reverend John Conley, S.J. We met him. He's one of the top Jesuits. Now, that Bloom, with his background, could have become the highest Jesuit in Ireland is a little bit unlikely, but theoretically it is true. The very Reverend John Conley, the Reverend T. Salmon, D.D., Provost of Trinity College. He is a high-ranking, he's the provost, the rector of Trinity College, it's called the provost, and Bloom saw him in the morning, the Reverend G. George Summits, and T is wrong, and one edition corrects it to the right name, but the right name is wrong and the wrong name is right, because when Bloom passed the house of the son, he thought of salmon, tinned salmon, is well tinned here, so the tin abbreviates Bloom's association and not tin. Dr. Alexander J. Dowie, the American evangelist. So you see, it's a little bit unlikely that Joyce could have become potentially, yes, Dowie. So at the bar, English or Irish, example, Seymour Bush, KC. That was a very famous lawyer. KC is King's Counsel, that the highest you can become. Rufus Isaac, KC, King's Counsel. On the stage, Bloom could have become a very famous stage. Modern or Shakespearean exemplars, Charles Wyndham, a very famous author at the time, High Comedian, Osmond Teale, as an exponent of Shakespeare. So these are the unlikely careers that we have. We stop here because the next section belongs together, and so we meet again in another week, and I wish you a happy resurrection over the Easter, and plenty of eggs, things like that. So in a week then, bye-bye.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Happy Easter.